This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 20th episode. For this episode, we return to the JCENM to review an article on the transition from denosumab to bisphosphonate therapy, which has been increasingly recognized in recent years as an important component of stopping treatment with denosumab. As is often the case with studies we discuss on this podcast, the investigators use observational data in their report, so we need to think carefully about that data and how it is used as we evaluate the results and conclusions that the authors draw. As a brief reminder, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, but spend most of my time at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where I work as a general endocrinologist, the medical director for our clinic, and an associate director for our fellowship program. Returning today to our virtual recording studio as our regular contributor is Amal Shibley-Rahal from the University of Iowa in Iowa City, where she directs their fellowship program and is an associate dean for the Carver College of Medicine. Importantly for us today, her clinical practice focuses on calcium and bone disorders with extensive expertise in that area. Joining us today as our guest expert is John Bilezikian from Columbia University in New York. Since he likely needs no introduction to any of you listeners, I'll briefly say that he is one of, if not the, world's experts on parathyroid and bone disease. He has conducted seminal research, written guidelines, won many awards related to these fields. He has been the editor for many textbooks and journals, including of the JCENM itself. So as I welcome these two perfect fits for our article today, I'll remind you all that everything we discuss is our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Today, we review the duration of denosumab treatment and the efficacy of zoledronate to preserve bone mineral density after its discontinuation, which the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published in October 2021. Polyzois Makros from the Hellenic Air Force and VA General Hospital in Athens, Greece, and Natasha Appelman-Dykstra from Leiden University in the Netherlands share the role of first author for this article. I'll now turn things over to Amal so that she can give us an overview of the author's introduction in addition to her and John reviewing key concepts in this field. Amal?
Thank you, Chase, and welcome everybody. I would like to start by setting the background for this study, in that patients on anti-resorptive therapy for osteoporosis may qualify for periodic drug holidays, where the anti-resorptive agent is discontinued for a period of time in an attempt to decrease the long-term risk of atypical subtrochanteric fractures. This practice initially originated with bisphosphonates and is associated with some increase in bone turnover and some bone mineral density loss. Although when you stop bisphosphonates, this phenomenon is not very accelerated or very severe. However, when denosumab is discontinued, a large increase in bone turnover is observed, coupled with a rapid decline in bone mineral density. And this phenomenon has been described as the rebound phenomenon. To prevent this rebound phenomenon, it is now recommended to first switch the patient from denosumab to a bisphosphonate for some time before discontinuing anti-resorptive therapy altogether. This practice has been named consolidation therapy. Several studies on the use of zoledronic acid as consolidation therapy have been published with variable efficacy at maintaining the BMD gain that is achieved with prior treatment with denosumab. I would like to stop a little bit here and bring in Dr. Bilezikian. John, can you comment on whether what we know so far about the efficacy of zoledronic acid as consolidation therapy is specific to zoledronic acid, or is it generalizable to oral bisphosphonates?
Well, Amal, thank you. Also, thank Chase and the Endocrine Society for inviting me to be part of this interesting session. Specifically, your question, Amal, is a good one. We lump the bisphosphonates in some respects together because they have a similar mechanism of action, namely as potent anti-resorptives. But these agents really are not similar in many respects. And with regard to zoledronic acid, this is a much longer-lived bisphosphonate. Its pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics are very different from the oral bisphosphonates and even from the other intravenous bisphosphonate, pamidronate. So I would say that we have to be careful extrapolating data from this paper and other papers related to zoledronic acid to other bisphosphonates.
I should point that although several studies have been published using zoledronic acid for consolidation therapy, none of these studies evaluated how the duration of prior treatment with denosumab may affect the trajectory of bone turnover and bone mineral density after patients are transitioned to zoledronic acid. So this study is set up to evaluate this question in a group of treatment-naive women with postmenopausal osteoporosis. The subjects were treated with denosumab for varying durations of time, followed by a single dose of zoledronic acid that was administered 6 months after the last dose of denosumab. At this point, I will transition back to Chase to walk us through the methods of the study.
Good. Thanks, Amala, and thank you, John, as well, for helping set the groundwork here. So I think we have a fairly good understanding of the landscape and why this is an important concept, and yet we don't know as much as we think we need to know or would like to know about this. So first of all, what we'll do is, as we often do, we'll take just a little bit of a step back and think about the study design here, the inferential method that is employed. And I think that'll help us then as we really dig into the methods of this paper and help us understand how they apply that methodology. So first of all, this is a prospective cohort study. So we've looked at these before, but I'll describe it in a bit more detail. So what makes a study a cohort study is when you have two groups of subjects. So you have an entire group, that's your cohort, but then within that you have at least two, sometimes more. This study has two. And in general, what you do is you split those groups, those subgroups, if you will, into exposed and unexposed groups. Now, we'll look at this here, and Amal has already suggested this, but the way we think about exposure will be just a little bit different. Typically, we dichotomize that. One group is a group that hasn't been exposed at all, and the other group has just been exposed. And sometimes you have multiple groups that have been exposed. So we're going to think about that because this is just a little bit different than how we would maybe assume that that would work. And then what happens, what makes this a cohort study, is that these individuals are followed over time for the development of an outcome. What makes it a prospective study is that this study is designed and started before any of the outcomes occur. So it's planned up front. You have your folks, you split them into groups, and then that's when your study starts. You then follow them in real time for the development of an outcome. It's a retrospective cohort study if you're looking at data that has already been collected in its entirety. So if you're starting your study after all of the outcomes have been performed. So generally speaking, prospective cohort studies are considered a little bit stronger, and that is usually because you have a bit more control over the data that you're collecting, both the exposure and then the outcome data as well. So that's what's used here. Okay, so we thought about prospective cohort studies in general. Now we're going to look at this study in a lot more detail. So first of all, we want to think about what makes up a cohort. So the cohort, again, is that large group of patients. And there are a couple of sources of patients, of subjects for this cohort that the authors describe. So first of all, the larger group actually comes from an RCT. And so this is a study that was called the After DMAB, abbreviation for denosumab. So After Denosumab study, and that's an RCT, a randomized controlled trial, again, of treatment naive women with osteoporosis. And in this RCT, these women were treated with denosumab until their bone mineral density in the hip or the spine moved from an osteoporosis range up into an osteopenia range. And then what made this an RCT is that those folks were randomized to being treated with zoledronate or not treated with zoledronate. And then, so for this study, this additional cohort study that's done, they took only those individuals who had that follow-up treatment with zoledronate. So this is part of the patients. The larger group comes from this RCT. There was another group of patients, and these were all individuals who fulfilled all the inclusion and exclusion criteria that applied for this RCT. They weren't a part of this. These were individuals who were treated at three clinics throughout Europe, but they had the same criteria. And so the authors thought that it was fair to include them because they were so similar from that perspective. They had originally identified 25 such individuals and then were able to include 20 of them in this study. So 20 from this secondary analysis here, and then from the RCT, the initial one, that was 27 people. So a total of 47 women who are included here. So I had a couple of questions, and I want to get John's input on this. And I think the biggest one to start out with is the way that the authors describe this treat to target approach. So they start individuals on denosumab and they continue it up until the bone mineral density moves from the osteoporosis range into the osteopenia range. So John, what insight can you give us into how that approach works? Is that a widely utilized approach or not necessarily? And if anything, how does that need to affect how we think about how these subjects were treated before this study was started?
Well, Chase, thank you for that question. It's an important one with specific reference to this paper, but in general, the way we treat patients with these various agents for osteoporosis. The treatment to target concept actually was stimulated by the availability of denosumab. Denosumab, different from pretty much any other drug we might consider using for osteoporosis, has a very long trajectory of gains in bone density. When I say long, we know from the original study that led to the registration of denosumab that there's a 10-year course of progressive increases in bone density. We also know more recently that the progressive increases in bone density are associated with progressive reductions in fracture risk. And this then becomes a very interesting discussion. At what point does the improvement in bone density no longer be associated with a further reduction in fracture risk? So the target is where we are going to. And with denosumab and now with the other bisphosphonates and other therapies, we speak about this osteopenic range, this osteopenic range between minus 1.5 and minus 2 is seemingly a threshold below which or above which, that is, if bone density gets better, you are not necessarily going to reduce fracture risk any further. So the target in this study, and as we think about treatment to target, is reaching an osteopenic T-score of somewhere between minus 1.5 and minus 2.
So now we're going to come back to think about how these individuals were put into the exposed and unexposed. And so this was what's a little bit different than how we typically think about this. So again, 47 individuals, a couple of different sources where these subjects came from, but they were retrospectively put into a couple of different groups. So one thing's a little bit unusual. Typically with prospective studies, all this stuff is decided up front before you follow these individuals. But in this study, there was a retrospective decision to divide these subjects into two groups, and that's based on the extent of denosumab exposure. So there's really no unexposed group. So everybody's been exposed to denosumab to some degree, but what's splitting you into one category versus another are those with limited denosumab exposure. And in this one, when they split them into two different groups, they define that the investigators did as having six or fewer doses of denosumab. So that in a way, as we think about that, that would essentially function as our unexposed group, though obviously they were exposed to treatment here. And then the group that we would classically think of as the exposed group had the longer duration of denosumab. So those were the individuals who had more than six doses. So a few more questions for John related to this. So one is just any thoughts that you might have on this decision being made retrospectively. And then a related question is often when these studies are done and folks are dichotomized, it might imply that there's a threshold effect that below this, something maybe doesn't happen. And above this, something does happen. Often things in medicine really happen on the continuum, though those studies are much more difficult to conduct. So John, any thoughts about how this study was arranged? Again, one, how this cutoff was decided retrospectively. And then the other one is really, does that make sense as a cutoff or would you have any questions about that?
Initially, I thought it might have been arbitrary. One could have even used the word capricious. How did they get the three-year point? And there might have been a reason for this because the original studies of this group used a duration of therapy of an average of 2.2 years with a range up to 4 years. This was before this additional group was added that became this study. So reading into this rationale, the original group had a median of 2.2. And to try to round out the number, it seemed maybe reasonable to use three. But I don't think there was any thinking that there was a cut point, a threshold, as you say, a dichotomized group here, below or above. I won't use the word arbitrary, but I think they made a decision. The data will actually, as we discuss it, will be interesting as we think about whether, in fact, there are two groups.
Yeah, good. That's helpful. And like I said, the decision was described as having been done after the fact, so retrospectively. So one does wonder if there was a component of looking at the data to try to see if there was a natural point that would make sense to divide folks into two groups. Again, not typically done with these prospective cohort studies, but it appears that that may have been done here. So another thing that I want us to think about as a group, and I suspect this is an item that we're going to come back to on several times, is the impact on this combination of splitting people into two groups and then using a treat to target approach. And this is something the authors point this out. So they acknowledge this. We're going to come back to this in the discussion and think a little bit more about their explanation of it. But what I think we need to think about is that when we split people into two groups here, the idea is it's what's going to be studied is the duration of denosumab. But individuals were not randomized into these groups. So in an RCT, with good randomization, generally everything is equal. But when folks are not randomized into one group or another, then you have to think, well, what made you end up in one group versus another? And I think a logical question is in this group is, did you end up in the group that required more doses of denosumab because your osteoporosis was more severe at baseline, or at least your bone density was lower at baseline, and that's why you then required more doses of denosumab to get your bone density back up into that osteopenia range? And then as we think about that, we'd have to think about, well, what kind of an impact is that going to have as we look at variable outcomes there, if maybe the groups are fairly different in ways other than how many doses of denosumab they got. So Amal and John, any thoughts about that? Again, I think we're going to come back to this later, but any initial thoughts is just a design of how we might need to be thinking about that as we move forward in the paper.
I agree. And that was one of the first thoughts that came to my mind reading through the study. Is this a statement about duration of exposure to denosumab, or is there a hidden statement in there about the severity of the osteoporosis, of the underlying osteoporosis? Particularly emphasizing what John just mentioned, and that bone mineral density continues accrual for many, many years on denosumab. So even though the two groups ultimately, before they were taken off the medication, reached a comparable T-score, is that the fact they needed longer or more doses of denosumab to reach that point, is that an indicator that they started with a more severe disease state?
Amal, I'd underscore what you just said. In a way, the treatment to target concept may have bollocked up these groups. As you said, it might have taken much longer to get to that target among those who had more severe osteoporosis. And we'll speak about what that may mean in terms of interpreting the data.
Good. Yes, we will definitely come back to that. So first of all, a few more words on the methodology here. So treatment details. So as an aside, all of the individuals, all the subjects in this study were on calcium, vitamin D supplementation. They all had normal serum levels as that was monitored throughout this investigation. And as far as the zoledronate, it was a standard 5 milligrams IV. And as Amal mentioned in her introduction, that was given 6 months after the last denosumab injection. And then there were not additional treatments that were a part of this study. A lot of data was collected. Amal is going to walk us through that here in just a second, but a few things that we want to highlight. So the bone mineral density data, that was obtained immediately before and then 12 months after the zoledronate was given. So importantly, this study did not include a report of what the bone mineral density was before the denosumab was given. And we're going to come back to that. That's another part of the explanation that the authors review in their discussion. So we're going to talk a little bit about that there, but I'd be interested again in Amal and John's thought here about not having that baseline information before the denosumab and how that's going to further affect how we think about the differences between these two groups.
Again, it goes back to the point I was trying to make earlier, and that leaves us with speculations about the severity of osteoporosis and the higher duration exposure compared to the ones that received 6 doses or less. Now, we do have a few hints that we will discuss when we get to the results section about potentially the severity of osteoporosis between the two, the difference in severity between the two groups. But again, I think this leaves a little bit of a hole there, some room for uncertainty, and would have loved to see what the pre-denosumab bone mineral density was. Thinking about it as a clinician from a practical point of view, when it's time for me to make that decision to switch them to zoledronic acid, it would have been another point of guidance.
You know, if we had been flies on the wall and were privy to the review of this paper, I wonder what the reviewers thought about that. They asked the authors, where are the original bone density data? And I wonder what that response, they just said they were, it wasn't part of the design of the study. So a very, very important question.
Yeah, so we'll come back to that again. We want to think about that. The authors are very upfront. They mentioned that. So I think that's good. And we'll think through that here when we get to the discussion. But yeah, an important concept in particularly observational study is it's very routine that the groups that you are evaluating are not the same. They got put into one group or another for one reason or another. And that can often be accounted for. At a minimum, you can recognize that the groups are different. But potentially, if you're actually able to measure what makes them different, you can account for that statistically. But the challenge is you actually have to be able to measure that, to quantify that so that you can factor that in. So a challenge there. So then another question for John, then as a follow-up here. So the authors mentioned that they monitor bone density at a couple of different sites. So lumbar spine and femoral neck are mentioned. So can you give us just a quick overview on exactly why it's helpful to have a couple of different sites, how those sites might have been variably affected either with anti-resorptive therapy or with stopping that? How should we factor in? What should we be looking for as we think about the data that we're going to hear from them all in a second about those different sites?
Patients ask me all the time, doctor, why are you measuring more than one site? We do at Columbia three-site DEXA. We measure the forearm as well. There's a good answer to that question, but let's take the lumbar spine and the femoral neck because those were the major sites of this study. The bones have different kinds of metabolism. There are bones that are rapidly metabolizing, their bone turnover is faster, and the lumbar spine is a wonderful example of that. The lumbar spine is primarily comprised of trabecular bone, and trabecular bone is that compartment that turns over fairly rapidly. Any intervention, therapeutic or otherwise, is likely to be seen initially at a site of more rapid bone turnover, such as the lumbar spine. The hip region is different, and specifically the femoral neck, but it speaks also to the total hip. It's more of an admixture of trabecular bone, like the lumbar spine, and the other kind of bone called cortical bone or dense bone. And that bone is primarily found in the non-vertebral skeleton, the distal forearm being a very good example, where 95% of the distal forearm at the one-third site is cortical bone. Cortical bone is more sluggish. It turns over much less rapidly. And any intervention, whether it be in a naive subject or in this case, those who have been treated, that the effects will be seen more slowly and not as much. So, coming back to the lumbar spine and the femoral neck, one would expect this kind of intervention. The results would be seen first and more evidently in the lumbar spine and less so at a site like the femoral neck.
Good. And I think that's going to help us understand the outcomes that were chosen, why they were chosen, which we're going to get to in just a second. One final word, though, on what data was collected. Bone turnover markers were also looked at. So specifically, P1NP and CTX were measured before 6 months and 12 months after the zoledronate was given. And again, Amal's going to walk us through those in just a second. Okay, so finally, on the methodology, we're going to think about outcomes. And for the reasons that John just walked us through, the primary outcome that the authors are interested in is the change in the lumbar spine bone mineral density. I think given that explanation, it makes sense. That's the one that you're going to see change the fastest. And so that makes sense that you would select that as a primary outcome. Several different secondary outcomes were identified in advance in this prospective cohort study. So one, the difference in the change in femoral neck bone density. Another one is the relationship between the duration of denosumab treatment and the bone mineral density changes. And then finally, the differences in bone turnover markers between the groups. And finally, the authors used what they described as an exploratory outcome, and that was looking for new fractures that happened throughout this study period. Now, I thought just as a final discussion before we move on past the methodology, is thinking about that, and I was curious to get Amal and John's thoughts on this as to why that was particularly labeled as an exploratory outcome. I understand to some degree it's a relatively short period of time. You wouldn't expect a lot of fractures to happen here. And so you could run into trouble if you made that your primary outcome. I was a little surprised to see that as an exploratory, since particularly in the world of osteoporosis, it seems that new fractures and particularly vertebral fractures are relatively well accepted as an outcome as you think about treatment with osteoporosis medications. But thoughts, Amal or John, on using that in particular as an exploratory outcome, particularly since it's the only real clinical outcome that a patient would experience?
Not so surprising to me, because this was a very small study. The thought that one could be able to see anything that was noteworthy would have been surprising. So I agree, even though that is an important clinical outcome, the way this study was designed, it would have been fanciful to think and or to make that outcome as either a primary or a secondary one.
I agree. In addition, some of the studies that I kind of alluded to in the introduction that have looked at the use of zoledronic acid after denosumab, even though they showed some bone mineral, some BMD loss, and some increase in bone turnover, did not have any significant increase in fractures. So a priori, you know that it's probably not going to be a frequent event, particularly in a small group with a short duration of time.
Thanks to you both. That clarifies then why the authors made that decision. Good. So now we've done our usual slow walk through the methodology here. So we'll move on to the results. And Amal is going to walk through those details with us as we think critically about the findings that the authors identified. Amal?
As Chase mentioned earlier, there were 47 postmenopausal women who participated in this study. 27 of them received 6 or less doses of denosumab. And 20 of them received more than 6 doses. At baseline, subjects who received more than 6 doses had a significantly lower body mass index compared to those who took more doses of denosumab. So the BMI was 24 in longer duration group compared to 28.9 in the shorter duration group. In addition, the subject who received more than 6 doses of denosumab had a higher prevalence of fractures compared to the other groups at baseline. There were no other significant differences in baseline characteristics between the two groups, and those are listed in Table 1 in the study for the listeners who are following along with the paper. So at this point, I would like to bring it to the group a little bit of discussion as what else might have been different between the two groups. So this is where we talk about confounders that would be important to know as we compare the outcomes between the two study groups.
Yeah, I think we talked about this before, but in observational studies, almost always the groups are different because they're not randomized into the groups. So I do think you want to think about that. That's one of the things that you look at in this table is to see, okay, what did the authors actually look at? And again, if you quantify that, you can at least recognize that the groups are different, and then potentially you can adjust for that statistically. One of the other things that I was thinking of, smoking is always something that you at least want to think about because of the huge impact there. Exercise, you maybe would think about, boy, that's a hard thing to quantify in some of these studies. So maybe not such a big deal, but those were at least a couple of different things. We talked obviously about the pre-treatment, the pre-denosumab treatment, bone mineral density is a huge one that we'd want to know, but we covered that a little bit already. So those are some of the ones that I would have been at least curious to know about.
Another thought would be, since the ones who had received more doses of denosumab than the others, that BMI, you know, in our day and age in the United States, a BMI of 24, we would say is really low. It isn't really low. It is normal. But it does bring up the question as to whether or not there were nutritional elements here. We know about vitamin D and calcium supplementation, but that doesn't really tell us specifically what the intake was. And it could have been another variable that is not accounted for, at least not obviously.
That's correct. Another important factor, or two factors to think about, are treatment with glucocorticoids and systemic inflammatory diseases. Thinking about risk of fractures and osteoporosis, I think it's important to capture those when we can. And again, it makes me wonder if there is a difference between those two groups and some of these underlying risk factors. Back to the results. The average age of all the participants together was 65.7 years. The subjects who received 6 or less doses of denosumab had an average duration of treatment of 2.2 years, like John alluded to previously. And those who received more than six doses had an average duration of denosumab treatment of 4.2 years. Now, these are the baseline characteristics. Now I'm going to move to looking at some of the outcomes that the study looked at. And first, I'm going to summarize the main outcomes related to changes in bone mineral density after the subjects received zoledronic acid. So if we look at the lumbar spine, which is really the primary outcome for this study, subjects who received six doses of denosumab or less experienced a 1% increase in their BMD on average. But overall, their BMD remained stable statistically over time compared to their baseline. By contrast, the subjects who received more than six doses of denosumab before they were switched to zoledronic acid experienced a 7% drop in their bone mineral density compared to their baseline. And this change was statistically significant. Another thing the study did is to compare the percent change in bone mineral density between the two groups. So when you look at the percent change in lumbar spine bone mineral density over the follow-up period between the two groups, there was a statistically significant difference between the shorter duration group and the longer duration group. At the femoral neck, subjects who received six doses of denosumab or less experienced a non-significant 1.26% increase in their bone mineral density from their baseline, while those who received more than six doses of denosumab experienced a significant 2.56% drop in the femoral neck bone mineral density from their baseline. However, when you compare the percent change in femoral neck bone density between the two groups, there was no statistical significance. Next, I'm going to look at the analysis of the correlation between the overall duration of denosumab treatment and the changes in bone mineral density 1 year after zoledronic acid. The researchers found a significant negative correlation between the duration of denosumab therapy and the percent change in lumbar spine bone mineral density with a correlation coefficient of minus 0.669. This means that the longer treatment with denosumab predicts a larger percent drop in lumbar spine bone mineral density after a patient is switched to zoledronic acid. There was no correlation between denosumab treatment duration and change in femoral neck bone mineral density. Next, I'm going to move to looking at what happened with the bone turnover markers during follow-up. If you look at figure three, you will see that at baseline, there was quite a bit of variability in the bone turnover markers, both the CTX and the P1NP, between the individual subjects in the study. When you look at the two groups separated, you will see that in both groups, there was a significant increase in both bone turnover markers, CTX and P1NP, during the year that followed zoledronic acid. And overall, there was no difference between the two groups in terms of the percent increase from baseline and their bone turnover marker. So the increase observed was similar in the two groups over the 1 year that followed zoledronic acid. In both groups, the CTX or P1NP at 12 months were below the upper end of the normal range for postmenopausal women. And there was a weak correlation between the P1NP value at 6 months and the duration of prior treatment with denosumab, but no other associations were seen. Next, I'm going to move into their fracture outcome. One patient in the group that received more than six doses of denosumab experienced an avertebral compression fracture, and this occurred 12 months after they switched to zoledronic acid. There were no other fractures in the study, as we just discussed and as predicted. In terms of side effects, other than some transient symptoms of acute phase reaction seen in about 49% of the patients after they received zoledronic acid, no other side effects were noted, including no cases of atypical subtrochanteric fractures and no cases of osteonecrosis of the jaw. Next, I will pass it back to Chase for some discussion of these findings.
Good. Thank you, Amal. So at this point, yeah, we do want to go through and we're going to talk about, first of all, what the authors say. So we're going to review how they look at their results, how they summarize those, what conclusions they draw from them. And then we're going to give you some of our own thoughts, questions that we have along the way as well. So first of all, as the authors describe it, they say that for postmenopausal women with osteoporosis treated with denosumab until the bone mineral density was in the osteopenia range, a single dose of zoledronate, couple different things that we conclude. So it maintained the bone mineral density gains if denosumab treatment was 3 years or less, but it did not maintain those gains if denosumab treatment was more than 3 years. So the way that they describe it is that duration of denosumab treatment is an important determinant of the response to zoledronate. We're going to come back to that here at the end. The authors point out that this is largely consistent with the rest of the literature, but they do point out that it was interesting that they noted that they were curious about the impact of this no difference in the change in bone turnover markers. And so they had to wrestle with that a little bit. And so first of all, they said that they did not think that their data supported the theory that zoledronate, that it doesn't control the greater stimulation of bone resorption from the longer duration of denosumab. And they also point out that unlike some of the recommendations that are out there in guidelines, is that their data also doesn't support a cutoff for bone turnover markers that would identify the high-risk patients or even support recommendation to monitor them in this setting. So specifically to decide who might need additional treatments, that doesn't really seem to support this here. So a couple of different things that they had to wrestle with there. And Amal, I know when we were preparing for this, you had some questions about, well, there's maybe some substantial variability here, maybe an impact of a relatively small numbers that's been mentioned already. So why don't you elaborate on what your question is that and how that might impact us thinking about the bone turnover markers.
Right. So John, I'm really curious to hear what you think about this. The bone turnover markers are notorious for having significant variabilities, kind of within test variability. And given the small number of subjects in this study, I am wondering whether that internal variability in the test may have potentially masked a significant change or difference in the overall trends. I mean, often when we look at these in big studies of hundreds and thousands of patients, the numbers dilute maybe some of the variability specific to the tests. But how do you think that may have played in masking potentially an effect here?
Yeah, Amal, that's a very good point. As many of you may know, one of the co-authors on this paper, and it comes from the group in Leiden, is Socrates Papopoulos. And Socrates is literally one of the world's experts in bone turnover markers. And I'm a little surprised that they didn't focus on what you just pointed out, because Socrates knows very well the tremendous inter and intra patient variability of these markers. There's another confounder here with regard to the experimental design of the study. That initial group that then was added to, all the markers were done at one time in one batch. But the second group had them measured as patients came through. So this introduces even a greater uncertainty. The point you made, Amal, is also well taken. A small number. Look at the scatter in figure 3. It's just so wide. It's amazing. I think what I would take away from the bone turnover data are there's a tremendous drive to return to some baseline, even in the context of a very potent anti-resorptive agent, zoledronic acid, can't control this proclivity to restore bone turnover towards normal.
I think that's helpful, and that's actually going to set us up for where the authors go next. So they say, well, if at least with the data that they have, it's not an obvious explanation where you can say, well, the bone turnover markers are higher in one group than another, so we can't obviously pin this on an increase in bone turnover here. So what alternative explanations might exist? So a couple of different things that the authors propose, at least as potential explanations. So one of them they suggest is, well, it's maybe, again, what we've thought about this before, is that maybe the longer treated women had more severe osteoporosis. They acknowledge that that's likely the case, and is suggested by them having lower BMI and more prevalent fractures. And so they suggest that similar to what John has talked about already, is that maybe this may be the phenomena of this mechanostatic reset to lower bone mass, and that may be what's driving that here. So John, can you elaborate on that? Exactly what is that idea, that theory that there, what is it that the authors are alluding to as a potential explanation?
Yes. Yeah. Chase, this is really an interesting point. It almost speaks to the perverse biology of this disease, that somehow the bones, as weak as they were, want to return to being weak. And the weaker the bones are, the greater the likelihood is that they're going to go back to the way they were. And that is this concept of the mechanostat. We've spoken previously, and we return to this question of maybe those who had been treated for a longer period of time had worse disease, and there was this disposition to return. And I'll make a point about a paper that we're not discussing today, but it relates to alendronate and the aftermath. And there was Calissa's work from David Kendler's group indicating specifically that the worse the bone density, the greater the chance of going back to this original poor bone density. So I say perverse because it doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would bones want to go back to being the way they were when they were getting better? But this concept seems to have some credibility.
Yeah, and I think whenever we evaluate observational data, there's many ways that these reports can be assessed for how accurate they are. One of the oldest methods, if not the oldest method, is considered the Hill criteria, which is just a long list of things that you look at. And interestingly, one of the criteria that's on there, one that I don't think is utilized very much, is analogy. I don't think it's a particularly strong one. However, it does raise an interesting, the way that you're describing this, the bone issue, I think is one that we often think about in obesity medicine as well. It's particular, if weight shifts up, there almost seems to be some natural draw that the body wants to maintain a weight like that. So I think it's interesting that that is potentially showing up in multiple areas in endocrinology. So just a final word here. And again, we've talked about this several times before, but I think there really is an issue with not knowing what that pre-denosumab treatment bone density is here. I agree with what John said. It was a little puzzling when the authors described this as having been excluded by design. And I'm not sure if either John or Amal have any insight onto why by design it would be excluded. I understand if for some reason you didn't have the data available, but it seems like it would be very important data that you would want to know and understand that in an RCT, maybe you weren't anticipating additional cohort studies spinning off of this, but still it's data that's obtained on a routine basis. So I think it's puzzling that it was excluded by design, because I think it very obviously it would have been important information to know here to help you understand how different these groups are beyond the duration of denosumab therapy.
Chase, yes, I agree. We've spoken about this. It is puzzling that the study wasn't designed to have that information. I don't know that we can go further, except that we wish that the study may have been designed so that this data would have been available.
So the authors also suggest another potential explanation. So that was one, that it was just the severity of the osteoporosis and this tendency to return to that baseline. They also suggest another potential explanation for their findings, and that is that possibly that the greater bone mineralization with the longer duration denosumab may not have been adequately maintained by just 5 milligrams of zoledronate. Whereas with less mineralization, with a shorter duration, maybe 5 milligrams is sufficient to maintain those gains. So that's another potential explanation that they suggest that would explain their findings. And so Amal, I'd like to get your input on here as well, because I think you had another question related to this, in particular about the idea of open resorptive surfaces with consolidation therapy and trying to see how that might fit in here. So why don't you ask that question for the group to help us wrestle with that?
Sure. Wondering what you guys think, and particularly what John, you think about the role of the concept of open resorptive surfaces being a player in maybe a less ideal response to zoledronic acid after denosumab. We've seen with transition to oral alendronate, the issue of decline in bone mineral density is less of an issue, and it has at least partially been attributed to the idea of frequent dosing, because, you know, then you keep hitting the resorptive surfaces as they open up over time, while with zoledronic acid, it's a single dose and you're done. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about this concept and to what extent it may explain some of the differences between the two groups that we're seeing.
Amal, this is an interesting discussion, and I was a bit surprised that they brought this explanation in the paper. This is very interesting work that David Dempster has published on this prolonged period of bone mineralization that seems to be active after denosumab through year 5, And then further bone mineralization doesn't seem to occur. And I think the group is trying to fit that concept into the notion that as bone mineralization is continuing to accrue, maybe there are more open or active surfaces that can be accessed by zoledronic acid, similar to what you said about alendronate. Weekly alendronate is likely to get to those open sites, let's say, more successfully than a once a year intravenous infusion of zoledronic acid. For longer periods of time with denosumab, maybe mineralization density has reached its maturity and those sites are not available, at least not as readily available. It's an interesting discussion because the Dempster data really doesn't dichotomize, if we use that word, into 2 years, 5 years, and 10 years. So I don't know. It's a theory, very hypothetical, and I don't think that's going to get us to where we want to go with regard to mechanisms of explaining this paper.
And so as we wrap up here, we're first of all going to think about how the author summarized things. So their conclusion, so they state that the duration of denosumab treatment is a significant determinant of the overall BMD response after a single zoledronate infusion among patients discontinuing denosumab. And then their implication of that is that they recommend that we should follow closely patients with longer than a three-year history of denosumab therapy, as these may need additional therapeutic interventions. So I want us to end, and we'll have Amal start first before we get to John. So Amal, what are your thoughts about the quality of this report overall? And then in particular, is this going to change the care that you provide? Do you agree with these implications? Is this going to either reinforce what you do already or actually lead to you changing the way that you approach these patients?
I don't want to dwell too much about the quality because we kind of like already dissected some of the weaknesses of this paper and some of the important data that are missing that we wish were there. Obviously, these are of concern to me, and I had mentioned earlier as a clinician, when I'm reading this paper, I think the lack of baseline bone mineral density information before denosumab is a major deficiency. But then I also wish I had a little bit more characterization of the risk factors between the two different groups to help me risk stratify my patients and decide who goes where or when do I stop denosumab and switch. I still do think, though, that it did add a little bit more information to previous reports in the sense of this concept of people who needed less denosumab to reach osteopenia, to reach target, may do just fine when I switch them over to zoledronic acid. Whether I want to interpret this as less doses of denosumab and all the subsequent effects on mineralization, or whether I simply want to interpret this as less severe osteoporosis at baseline, and that's why it needed less denosumab to get to osteopenia, I think it's still helpful to know that this particular group that can reach osteopenia in a shorter period of time seems to be a safer group to potentially switch to zoledronic acid. I have to do more thinking and more work with my more severe cases who I know had much worse bone mineral density at baseline or a lot of significant fractures at baseline, or who needed many, many years of denosumab before they achieved target.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And I think, yeah, we kind of quibble, and particularly with the phrasing of determinant. I'm not sure it's the denosumab that's determining. It may be. It may just be associated because, again, it is more severe osteoporosis. But I agree with you. I think it did really help add beneficial information because it at least raises awareness is that we can't always just assume one dose of zoledronate, good, we're done, we've maintained these gains, we're finished here. Maybe, maybe not. We at least need to be thinking, hey, this may not be everything. There may be additional therapies that are needed. Again, we may not know exactly how to identify those people, but I think anything that helps raise awareness of potential gaps in our understanding of where we may be missing opportunities to beneficially intervene with these folks is important for us to identify. But John, let's finish with you. So final words, what are your thoughts on this study overall and as far as its potential of either reinforcing or changing the care that we provide to patients?
Well, thank you, Chase. I've always thought that the mark of a successful paper is whether it is provocative. And this is a very provocative paper. It raises a lot of questions, I think, is added to what we know, and it's added to what we would like to know by inference. reached a conclusion that the authors also thought might be, and that is the more severe the osteoporosis, the more likely it is that zoledronic acid as one dose won't hold the gains. Another point, and I'd like to just refer briefly to figure two, which was relating the change in bone density with the duration of therapy, and it's a straight line, as you mentioned, Amal, with a significant R value. So it isn't a dichotomous cohort here. This is a continuum. And I take away from this paper to be really even more diligent, as we're all coming to that conclusion, the more severe the osteoporosis, the more likely it is that they're going to need further therapy. And one follow-on dose of zoledronic acid is less likely to hold them than those who have less severe osteoporosis.
And with that, I would like to thank Amal Shibley-Rahal and John Belazikian for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal today and hope you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.